You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Okay, good morning.
No,
we'd like to get going. I'm Darrell West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation here at the Brookings Institution. And I'd like to welcome you to our forum on the economic costs of internet shutdowns. And we are webcasting this event live, so I'd like to welcome our viewers from around the country as well as around the world. And we are archiving the video as well, so anyone who would like to view it afterwards can do so at the brookings.edu website. And we welcome any comments or questions that you have. We've set up a Twitter feed at hashtag internet shutdown. That's hashtag internet shutdown. So if you wish to post comments during the forum, feel free to do so. So the internet is a growing source of gross domestic product in many countries. We see a tremendous increase in e-commerce and the use of online services. This creates great opportunities for businesses, and it contributes to the long-term economic development of countries around the world. But yet at the same time, there are powerful forces that are threatening the vitality of the digital economy. In recent years, a number of countries have blocked particular applications. They have shut down specific services. They've turned off mobile services, and they've disrupted the entire internet. This obviously damages the economy in those home countries and disrupts e-commerce and online service delivery. Right now, Ethiopia has shut down the internet in response to public protests against the government. In other countries, for example, in India, when there are student entrance exams, sometimes local communities shut down mobile services in those areas to keep students from cheating. So there are a wide variety of rationales the governments are using, but the sad reality is we're seeing an increase in these types of shutdowns, and this is a worrisome trend for the global marketplace. So today, we have released a paper that estimates the economic impact of temporary internet shutdowns. In the paper, I identify 81 short-term shutdowns that have taken place in 19 countries over the past year. So between July 1st, 2015, and June 30th, 2016, I found that these shutdowns cost their home countries at least $2.4 billion in GDP activity. And the paper presents our methodology and talks about the data on which we relied to develop these estimates. We also developed specific estimates for each shutdown and then aggregated by country so you can get a sense of which countries are experiencing the greatest economic damage. And we found that economic losses included $968 million in India, $465 million in Saudi Arabia, $320 million in Morocco, $209 million in Iraq, $116 million in Brazil, $72 million in the Republic of the Congo, $69 million in Pakistan, $69 million in Bangladesh, $48 million in Syria, $35 million in Turkey, and $20 million in Algeria, as well as in other places. So you can see that the economic damage is significant here. And as the digital economy grows, this economic damage is likely to accelerate and further weaken global economic development. So we want to encourage countries to maintain digital service so as to not damage their own domestic economies. There also are interests in terms of keeping the internet open in order to preserve freedom of expression, promote human rights, and promote healthy civic dialogue. We argue in the paper that many nations are shooting their economies in the foot and damaging the livelihoods of their very own inhabitants. So it's something they should be concerned about as the digital economy grows. Any of you who would like more details, those of you who are here today, you can get copies of the report outside the auditorium. Those of you who are watching online, the report is available at brookings.edu. So in order to discuss internet shutdowns, we put together a distinguished set of speakers who have a lot of expertise on this topic. So I'd like to welcome Kath Cummins. She is the Director of Communications and Outreach at the Global Network Initiative. Kath is responsible for the initiative's engagement with policymakers and stakeholders. She came to GNI after working as a journalist, magazine editor, and communications advisor in the United States, the United Kingdom, China, and Australia. And prior to joining the initiative, she was the Director of Public Affairs at the D.C.-based National Center for Victims of Crime. Taylor Reynolds is the Digital Policy Director for the Internet Policy Research Initiative at MIT. In this role, he leads the development of technology policy and helps policymakers address digital policy challenges in a variety of different areas. Previously, he served as senior economist at the OECD, and he led the organization's information economy unit. He also worked on a major study of the economic costs of the internet shutdown that took place in Egypt several years ago. We reference the study in our paper as well. Deji Olukonan is the Senior Global Advocacy Manager at Access Now. He manages the global campaigns to fight internet shutdowns and protect free expression. Prior to this job, he worked at the Penn American Center, where he founded the group's Digital Freedom Program. And he holds a JD from the Stanford Law School and has a master's degree from the University of Cape Town. So I'd like to start with Kath, and if you can just tell me about the work being done at the Global Network Initiative as it relates to internet shutdowns.
Well, thank you to Daryl, and thank you to the Brookings Institution for creating a space to draw attention to this increasingly important issue. We see network shutdowns through a human rights lens, but we also recognize that human rights and economic development and prosperity are issues that are intertwined, that build on each other, and that when human rights are harmed, economies are harmed, and when economies are harmed, human rights are harmed. We think that network shutdowns is an issue that is only going to grow in importance, and it's something that the Global Network Initiative is going to sort of do escalating work on. But before I talk a bit about that, I should say a little bit about the Global Network Initiative. It's a bit of a mouthful of a name, so let me deconstruct it. We're a multi-stakeholder initiative, which is different from being an industry association or an advocacy organisation. Think of us as a conversation, as a forum, and around our table are some of the most influential and important internet companies on the planet, as well as human rights organisations, press freedom groups, academics that specialise in digital rights, and socially responsible investors. Think of it as Thanksgiving dinner, if you like. It's often a very robust and a rich discussion. We don't always agree, and that is as it should be. But when we speak with one voice, it's a very powerful voice. And on network shutdowns, we don't only speak with the voice of human rights groups and internet companies, but we also speak with the voice of telecommunications companies. And that's because GNI has now been joined by 7 global telecommunications companies as observers. They're on track to be members of our organisation next year. And so it's an even more powerful voice that we speak with when we talk about network shutdowns, when we bring these incredibly large and influential companies together in our multi-stakeholder human rights framework. So that's who we are. I mean, we work on a lot of issues. Network shutdowns is just one of them. But this is something that we think right now needs a lot of attention. Daryl mentioned the shutdown in Ethiopia that's going on right now. We consider this, you know, good. We can talk about something that's happening in real time. But actually, we could host this event any day of the year, and somewhere in the world there will be a country or more countries that are using network shutdowns as a tool against their own populations. And so we see this as something that, even though it is more recently been pushed off the front pages, it was on the front page when we talked about the shutdowns in Egypt, but it's become the new normal, and that's something that we want people to understand has devastating implications for human rights and for economies around the world, particularly developing economies. So that's who we are, and that's why we're focused on network shutdowns. A couple of things to to keep in mind. I mentioned that the economic harms and the human rights harms are very difficult to disentangle. And I think a really important message that we want to get through to governments around the world is that you have to stop seeing shutdowns through a security lens and start seeing shutdowns through an economic development lens. Because if we don't do that, then there will just be an ever-increasing amount of use of this particular tool against populations. What is really important about the study that that Daryl has done with Brookings is that they've taken an approach where they've measured the economic harm, but they've also raised some really critical questions about where this research can go in the future. That $2.4 billion figure doesn't talk, you know, doesn't even take into account the loss of tax revenue, doesn't take into account the loss of consumer and business confidence. It doesn't measure the businesses that haven't been started, the connections that haven't been made, the communities that haven't been empowered. So, you know, we feel like the research that is beginning to be done on this issue is just the beginning. We're very encouraged by it. And what we would like to see is obviously more of it. So the more the better. I'm very pleased to hear that Brookings has a long-term commitment to this issue and will be continuing to discuss it. GNI will be releasing its own report on network shutdowns in the very near future, so keep an eye out for that. And I guess my main message, other than to say we have to stop seeing shutdowns as a security issue and start thinking about it as an economic issue, is that if we are really serious about taking this issue on, then we have to think about it in a multi-stakeholder framework. We can raise this issue, we can put it on the world agenda, but the next step has to be how do we engage governments directly to mitigate and prevent these shutdowns? And that's where an organisation like GNI comes in, because we can raise these issues, but without the tools and the forums to engage governments, none of this work translates into real practical reform. What the GNI is committed to doing is to creating opportunities for governments to have conversations with companies, academics, human rights and press freedom groups and other stakeholders to educate them about the real costs of shutdowns and also to bring into strong focus the harms that are caused to human rights. So that's what we're about. I guess I'll leave that there. But keep in mind that we can focus on this issue, but we have to take that next step and ask ourselves how. How do we make governments change their behaviour?
Okay, Deji, Access Now is one of the big players in the internet shutdown area, so can you tell us a little bit about the work your organisation is doing on this?
Sure, yeah. For those of you who aren't familiar with Access Now, we extend and defend the digital rights of users at risk around the world. We have a 24-hour digital security helpline, which we offer to human rights defenders, journalists, and people at risk. So we've been working on this. We've talked about Egypt because I think that was the moment when the world realized that shutting down networks was a real possibility. And we've actually been involved since that moment. But what I wanted to talk about was where we are now, which is very exciting. We have a campaign called Keep It On. So in addition to the hashtag Internet Shutdowns, please use the hashtag Keep It On. We have over 100 organizations from around the world, civil society organizations, some of whom are in the room today. Some of them are watching on the live stream. I want to salute you. And from over 50 countries, and many of the members of these organizations are in countries that are directly impacted by internet shutdowns. How did we come to this space where we have a coalition? Well, we realized at that time in Egypt, and then soon after, as this trend continued that it's been discussed, that shutdowns are really early warning signs of atrocities. So governments will shut down the internet, and there are a few players. I think it's worth mentioning that there's few major actors in this space that Kath mentioned. One is governments, the companies, the ISPs and telecommunications companies, and then that impacts internet applications and then also end users. So there's a few actors in this space, all of whom have a role, and that's why it's multi-stakeholder. But what we realized was that governments would shut down the internet and people would die. And that trend continues today. The Ethiopia example that's happening right now, the internet was shut down, 50 people or more were killed, as many as 500 estimated by Human Rights Watch since the beginning of this year, and each one of those deaths has some link to an internet shutdown. We've also seen that they happen increasingly around elections, which are the most critical moment in a democracy. We saw this play out in Uganda in February this year, where President Museveni was up for re-election, shut down mobile networks, shut down mobile banking for 4 days, and put the opposition leader under house arrest, ordered the telecommunications companies to shut down the internet. It was amazing because that was actually a moment where you could see the chain of events, because the regulator, the telecommunications regulator, made the order public. MTN, which was one of the mobile providers, published the order and explained why it happened to them. And then people went online to get around the block. Over a million virtual private network applications were downloaded to allow people to circumvent. It's not always possible to do that, but we saw this whole range. And somewhere in there, the government of Uganda regulators said they would punish anyone who downloaded a virtual private network application. So you saw, and just related to this paper, which, as Kath mentioned, is a wonderful baseline and a starting point to understand the economic impacts. But from my understanding, mobile banking, those 4 days, the mobile banking would not have come in these results. So Uganda would be much higher. And we saw a wide range of estimates, but in terms of the tax revenues, we saw as much as $23 million a day our travel over Uganda's mobile banking network. So that just shows how this is really a beginning. The problem is much larger. But that's painting sort of a dire picture. We've had some amazing victories to start already. The first is at the UN Human Rights Council, which passed a resolution in June unequivocally condemning internet shutdowns. The language was very specific. We had the wonderful statement from the Global Network Initiative and the Industry Dialogue. And then the GSM Association, one of the world's largest technology associations, put out really strict standards that comport with international law. So we're seeing some mobilization. We have a lot more to do, but it's encouraging that companies, governments, and telecommunications companies, and now think tanks are taking this issue seriously, because it really is a multi-stakeholder problem. You know, I'll stop there and.
Okay. So Taylor, you're at MIT and leading work on technology policy, and you also helped author the estimates of the $90 million in economic costs from the Egyptian internet shutdown. So tell us about your work in this area.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm honored to be here. In January 2011, I actually had a plane ticket, and as did a couple members of our team, to fly to Egypt and complete a telecom review of their country that had been asked for that had been requested by the Egyptian government. So we were actually in the process of working with the communications ministry to look at their telecommunications sector, say what's working and how can we support businesses with more in Egypt. And then all of a sudden we saw, you know, the Arab Spring, internet get shut down, and one of my colleagues, Arthur Mikolait, approached me and said, you know what, we have all of this data that the Egyptian government on our first visit has given us about their telecommunications sector. Why don't we start analyzing this and look at what are the costs of shutting down the internet for 5 days? So we did this, and we did it relatively quickly. We jumped in, we took a look at the numbers, and came up with an estimate of just direct costs. And I need to emphasize, these are just the lost telecom revenues from shutting down the internet to the telecom carriers. And we came up with a number of 18 million per day, which worked out to be 90 some odd million and 90 million over the course of 5 days. And we published the number just quickly on our website. And it went all over the place because people were looking for some way to measure what this cost was. I think everyone on the ground realized that this was a problem, but no one had really gone in and looked at the methodologies behind how would you calculate what the economic loss is here. I want to point out, though, that that 90 million number that we came up with for 5 days actually was only the direct costs. And one of the interesting things that we heard at the time was that in New Zealand, you had Vodafone, which was is a mobile operator there. And Vodafone in New Zealand actually used call centers in Egypt to handle about one-third of its customer service traffic. So here you have the internet that gets shut down in Egypt, which seems like a localized problem, and all of a sudden people in New Zealand can't get to customer service on Vodafone's network, on their mobile network. So there's these linkages all over the world that happened as a result of this takedown, and we weren't able to measure any of those effects. I think we pointed out in our release that we put out that this was a billion-dollar industry in India. The remote call centers was a billion-dollar industry. And if you cut off the internet for 5 days, you're going to shake confidence in businesses in doing business in your country, which would have a much larger impact than the 90 million of lost telecom revenues. So we went on from that to do a much larger piece that looked at different methodologies for measuring the internet economy that the OECD published back, I think, in 2013, that looks at ways of measuring from direct effects. So you had direct effects, you had dynamic effects, which was how GDP grows as a result of the internet, and then you had kind of indirect effects, which covered things that aren't measured in GDP, like consumer surplus. So you had these three different effects. And as we've seen as well, we see more and more of these shutdowns, and it feels like countries and policymakers are not quite understanding what's going on behind this. I think kind of the three messages I'd like to get across are, number one, these takedowns don't work. You know, just ask North Korea trying to keep out South Korean dramas. It does not work. And when you shut down the internet in Turkey, they're going to find ways around it. You know, you'll see Google's DNS lookups posted all over the place. It just does not work. And I think that information and that message needs to get out. It's also extremely difficult to measure. And one of the things we did is we brought together at the OECD 50 experts from around the world and, you know, and said, how would you tackle this problem? And there were many different ways that fell into many different solutions. It is not an easy thing to measure because of, you know, if you cut off access to the internet, people might be able to use SMS. You've got all sorts of cross-elasticities to deal with, and measurement is an issue. The third thing is, surprisingly, when we were working with Egypt, the Egyptian government is actually very forward-thinking. The communication ministry was very forward-thinking, and we're pushing for reforms. And that side of the government, you know, I don't know what was behind the decision, but I'm sure they were not part of that. Mm-hmm. And that must have come from somewhere else. And I think we have a role to play in convincing the economic ministers and the executive branch of their governments that this is a bad idea. Because the communication ministries, I think, understand. But we need to get the message out that this hurts the economy. Lastly, I'll just tell you a little bit about the initiative I'm with now. I'm based at MIT. We're a new group called the Internet Policy Research Initiative. And I think we sit in a really interesting place where we bring in some of the world's best technologists, and we have some of the world's best policymakers who come together and work on technical issues and policy issues surrounding cybersecurity, privacy, advanced network architecture, and what we call the internet experience, which is where this fits in. We have a group led by Dave Clark, who's one of the original architects of the internet, that looks at how you measure internet traffic and congestion, and his work is also looking at takedowns. So it's an interesting area, and we're happy to be here with you and talk more about this issue.
Okay, great. So let me throw out a question and get each of your reactions. So we've given several examples of countries that have shut down the internet or mobile services. But let's step back from particular examples and just think, what are the factors that you are seeing that are driving this trend towards shutdowns? Kath, we'll start with you.
Well, I was going to say, maybe you start?
Sure, yeah.
Sure, go ahead.
Definitely. I touched on a lot of them. Elections is probably the number one, especially in Africa at the moment. It's not an African problem, and I think that's important to note. We recorded over 20 different countries, many in Middle East, North Africa region, India, Pakistan. Bahrain has an ongoing shutdown that's happening right now. Another one would be public unrest. So people are expressing themselves. They have these amazing new tools. We're not that new. But they're learning to organize. That's empowering. And this is kind of a knee-jerk response to shut it down. So protests, there are shutdowns around protests. I would say that those are the main contributing factors at the moment. I think what's interesting is I'd like to, with each of these, it seems like they're inevitable and they're just going to keep continuing. But actually, if you look at the case of Ghana, a police chief said that he was going to, was considering banning social media or blocking social media during this election that's coming up in December. At the time, it was in November. Public civil society pushed back. And now the president himself has declared that and committed to keeping social media on. So it is possible to win. We're also seeing another trend is that the blocking is getting more sophisticated. So more targeted. And I mentioned Bahrain, and that one was so complicated that researchers at Citizen Lab and an organization called Bahrain Watch had to really understand what was happening. Because in our definition of shutdowns, a throttling or an unusable internet is still a shutdown. And that's what was happening. It's still happening every night in Bahrain, in this particular neighborhood, to users who go to that neighborhood on certain mobile networks. So it's getting more sophisticated. But those are a couple of the trends that we've observed. And we have a post coming up, I think, this week, which identifies some other ones that we've seen. Yep.
Kath or Taylor?
I think that probably covers a lot. I mean, a couple of things I would add. This is not an issue that's confined to what we would traditionally consider authoritarian governments. These are emerging democracies. These are highly democratic countries like India, for example. Huge democracies like Brazil. So, on the one hand, the headlines will capture elections, protests, and others if they capture them. But there's also, a sort of ongoing low-level issue that doesn't get a lot of attention. One example that stands out for us is in a country like India, regional governments are extremely powerful. They have a lot of power over connectivity. And if an entire region is shut down, it's a massive population and we're not necessarily going to get outrage on the world stage about it, but it's a serious problem. There's also instances where governments or the judiciary are punishing companies for non-compliance with government requests. We've seen the shutdown of the social media networks in Brazil, for example, like WhatsApp. I think this idea that there's a growing array of tools and sophistication is an important one to keep in mind, and that. In the report that we'll be coming out with, one of the things that we've highlighted is that as countries go more and more online and their populations become more connected, there seems to be a kind of sweet spot. I hesitate to use that because it's a terrible sweet spot for governments where there's a reasonable level of connectivity, and that seems to be where the shutdowns are most valuable to governments. And then after that, as the population gets more and more online, it becomes harder and harder for governments to wield that tool without serious consequences. So I guess that's what I would add, yeah.
Taylor?
What I would add to that is we had a discussion with some of our leading network engineers not too long ago asking about these internet shutdowns. And one of the things that they came back with was it is very difficult even now to pinpoint the cause of an internet when the internet doesn't work. It's very difficult for them to figure out. And it can happen for political reasons, it can happen for network reasons, and it can happen for other reasons. And I think it's important for us to figure out a way, I think that's one of the tasks ahead, mm-hmm. is to separate these out. Because if we can isolate the issues that are politically related, I think it's much easier to make a case for the negative effects. If it's just standard network shutdowns that happen periodically, or breakdowns because of electricity, for example, that's another issue. So I think we have a big role to play there. We do see more of these taking place, it seems like, in the popular press. And I thought in the report, Dale did a great job of listing the, you know, a very detailed list of shutdowns that have been seen around the world. And I think we need just to have a better understanding of where they're happening and why.
Yeah, I'll just jump in. The definition that we have on our website, accessnow.org, keep it on, it's at the top. We only include intentional disruptions. Mm-hmm. So we exclude the kind of network anomalies that happen. So that's why the verification piece of it is so important, whether from someone who is experiencing it firsthand, an end user, or from a telecommunications company, or finding the government order, for example, which happened in Iraq earlier this week. I left out school exams. So school exams is another really major one. And it's sort of the advent of technology meeting rote examination and multiple choice tests. So you have this kind of these new tools, Facebook, and various ways of communicating, different platforms. And these are important exams, like school entrance exams. Sometimes they're in Iraq, they tend to be for sixth graders. So important, you know, but in Ethiopia, with a similar thing happened, was for university entrance exams. And the stakes are high. So sometimes even teachers will sell the exam results to their own students, who will then pass it around on whatever social media tool they use. So the response has been, rather than, I think it's hit this system of administration, exam administration, they weren't quite ready for it. So when I talk to teachers in the U.S. about this problem, they say, oh, well, I changed the answers, I don't have all multiple choice. So there are ways around it, and a good proctor can stop this problem. But when you have thousands of people and they're not ready for it, the knee-jerk response has been to shut off the internet. So this week, I think it was October 1st through 5th, Iraq was shutting down the internet for 3 hours, for the entire country except for Kurdistan. So not just blocking certain social media, but shutting down the internet. And that's another major problem that's been happening.
Let me ask one last question, then we'll open the floor to questions from the audience. So, you know, we clearly are seeing a lot of problems in this area. There seems to be an accelerating trend. The economic damage as e-commerce grows is going to continue to accelerate. What are the best ways to discourage countries from doing these things?
We need to educate. And we need to engage. The education comes from the work that's being done to document the harms, to raise awareness around the world. But the engagement is going to be the critical how in this. And the way to do that is to use the leverage of governments, of companies, of civil society working together. This is, as we've said, it's a global problem. It will only have a multi-stakeholder solution. There is no other solution. Governments on their own, are not going to solve this problem. Companies on their own are not going to be able to solve this problem. So one of the things we're encouraged is that if a group like GNI can bring telecommunications internet companies together, as well as human rights organisations, as well as other parts of civil society, that can be a powerful mechanism for engaging governments. And the second thing I would say is that when we engage governments, we don't just have to engage the government that is using the tool. Governments are connected as well. Governments out of Europe, for example, United States, are powerful donor countries to many of these countries. The World Bank and other international institutions have a big role to play in this. And I think it's incumbent on all of us to find ways to engage those institutions. And I think one of the things that's come out of the Global Network Initiative's work on this is that it's not enough to react during a crisis. There's actually very little that you can do once a government has made a decision to shut the networks down and give an order. There's not a lot that the company on the ground can do if they're being faced with threats to their local staff. So the window for engagement is actually before the storm, before the crisis. And so if we can find mechanisms and forums for governments to be educated and to be engaged on this, ahead of the crisis, then we're going to come a long way to mitigating or preventing these shutdowns.
Did you?
Yeah, I completely agree with that, that it is a multi-stakeholder problem. It's the very nature of one, and that makes it very exciting because that's also where the solutions are.
Yeah.
And there's really a lot of reasons to collaborate. You know, one of the things we're looking at is because our helpline, it's a 24-hour digital security helpline, we do have to respond, and the members of our coalition do have to respond as they're happening. So we do need to have some circumvention advice. How do you get around the block if it's possible? How do you document? Reaching out to journalists who have such a huge role in this, because not only are they recording the kind of human rights violations that are happening around them, but they're often the first ones to actually document the disruption in context. So they don't just on a technical level, but they actually understand why it's happening and where it's happening, and they can verify. So that's super important. But I do think the norm shifting of the UN and going for these top governments and multi-stakeholder bodies, multilateral bodies, getting them to make statements and take a stand. But I do think the economic impact is so huge, and understanding that. So many of these countries in developing world particularly say, we're open for business, come invest in us, and then shut down the network. So being able to point that out and point to some numbers is going to be really powerful, and I hope we can continue doing more research like this.
Taylor?
Great. I've just got a couple. Interestingly, in many countries, you have a very centralized connectivity out to the world for the internet. And one of the things that we would recommend, or that I would recommend, is that you have a more decentralized structure. So if you've got a country where there's one internet exchange point where all of the operators exchange traffic, it's very easy to walk in and just pull the plug, and all of a sudden you lose connectivity throughout the whole country. We have been arguing from a network planning standpoint that you should have multiple exchange points, which would decentralize your network and make it more difficult for parts to go down all at once. And I think that could help from a political standpoint as well. The second, no one had mentioned this yet, but I think it's important to ensure that governments have a pretty good social media footprint themselves, and that policymakers are actually using these technologies. Because if this is a tool that they also use to communicate, then they're going to be less likely to take it down when they need to respond to things in the press, in the media. So I think getting them more online and understanding what's going on is a good thing. And third, I think it's important for us to have some centralized databases that look at when things are shut down. And what that allows is academic researchers at places like MIT to go in and try and figure out what's going on, come up with numbers. But to have some sort of centralized database would be extremely helpful.
Okay. Let's open the floor to any questions or comments from the audience. We have microphones, so just raise your hand, and we will get to you. Right here is a gentleman with his hand up.
Hi, Daryl. Greg Nogi. I'm from Center for Democracy and Technology. Could you just walk us through one example of how you calculated these numbers? I'm looking on page 9 of the report. The Brazilian judge ordered the shutdown of WhatsApp, and the number on May 2nd, and then following another shutdown in December 2015, the May shutdown was for a day, and it cost the Brazilian economy $39 million. How did you get to that number?
Great question. On pages 6 and 7 of the report, I have detailed formulas outlining the data that we used to derive those estimates and how we did it. So just to give you an example, what we would do is, like in the case of a national mobile shutdown, like if the mobile network was being shut down across an entire country, we would take the national GDP for that country. We would measure the duration, the percent of the year. So, you know, one day, one week, one month. We would look at the extent of the digital economy, which we measured as a percentage of that nation's economy that comprised the digital component. There are estimates that are available for each of those things. The extent of the mobile penetration, which we measured as a percentage of the country having mobile subscriptions, and then we incorporated a multiplier effect. So basically, we were able to get data for each of those aspects and then computed the economic cost. I do want to point out we used a very conservative approach here in the sense that, as Kath pointed out, we didn't look at the tax costs to the loss of economic activity. We don't look at indirect effects. There are a variety of other negative economic consequences that we don't seek to estimate. In addition, we all know that the digital economy is growing year by year. In some cases, the most recent data that we had in particular countries was 2 or 3 years old. And so the $2.4 billion figure that we give for the world as a whole is likely to be a low estimate of the actual damage. But that's how we derived our numbers. Other questions? Don't be shy. Oh, over here is a question.
I was wondering if you also kept in mind the costs of internet slowdowns, because there are probably ways in which the shutdown of the internet is like an extreme measure, but you can slow it down, especially maybe closer to moments in time that are very important, politically speaking.
Yes, absolutely. There certainly would be economic costs of slowdowns, kind of throttling down, more targeted or more selective ways in which traffic is slowed. We were not able to develop estimates of that. So again, that's an economic cost that we did not compute in ours. So that's the reason I'm saying it's a very conservative approach that we used, and our estimate is likely to be a low measure of the actual damage.
Can I jump in and share an experience that we had working with these types of methodologies at the OECD when I was there? These are really difficult numbers to calculate because in some instances you're underestimating and in other instances you're overestimating, and you kind of are hoping that everything works out in the middle. It's a very difficult thing to do because on one hand you have, if I can't send an email to someone, I may be able to send a text. So that's not necessarily lost. It's just substituted for something else. So that would be overestimating the impact. But on the other hand, there are all these effects that are not captured by your model. So, you know, you're trying to find a balance somewhere in the middle. And I think that when reports like this come out with numbers, they're there to give kind of a big idea, not to be precise, because they can't be very precise, but they give a general idea that this is a problem of a certain magnitude. And I think one of the things that we're really excited about is working together to try and figure out how do we come up with some more precise measurements using new data that's available with big data from some of the partners that we can come out with. I think there's some really exciting things we can do, but we have to kind of look at it in the big picture.
Yeah, and in our definition, we record, it looks, if the internet is effectively unusable. So that is considered, we consider that a disruption. And, you know, we kind of have this joke where we say, you know, the only thing worse than no internet is a slow internet. And we've all experienced that.
That's right. We experienced that in the United States, too, from time to time. So other questions? Right here on the aisle.
So I'm interested in understanding more about what these numbers will mean in terms of negotiating with the governments that are causing the shutdowns. And I know there was a point made about the spectrum of regional and national efforts to shut down the government. Some countries are a little bit worse than others. And in countries where you see these human rights violations, clearly what matters more to them is staying in charge of their country than it does that a few people are going to get killed for voicing their opposition. So for countries like that, for kleptocracies and governments where corrupt leaders are managing the decisions, even though there might be factions that disagree, for those countries, how would an economic loss truly influence their decision to keep the internet running?
I mean, our analysis, we focused on the economic costs because we felt this was a way to play to the self-interest of the people shutting down the internet. Like, you know, if it's an authoritarian government and there are human rights violations, they don't care. you know, they're willing to bear that cost, as you point out, in order to stay in power. But even authoritarian governments, and certainly democratic governments fall in the same category, they're pushing economic development. You know, they're telling the world, we're open for business, come invest in us. But then if, on the other hand, they're turning around and shutting down the government and hurting economic development and harming businesses, then they're shooting themselves in the foot. So we tried to make the argument in ways that would actually resonate with them. In a lot of these countries, the digital economy as a percent of overall GDP is still relatively low. We're talking about, you know, 4, 5, or 6%, depending on the country. But we know that number is growing year by year. So in a few years, those countries are going to be in a situation where 10 or maybe even 15% of their GDP is going to come from online services and the digital economy. When they shut it down, that's really going to hurt their economy. So we just wanted to get them to start to focus on the ways they are harming their own people and their own businesses.
Can I add one thing on this? So the number that we chose to use, we talked about how large of GDP at first when we talked, you know, this is equivalent to a certain amount of GDP. I think one thing to keep in mind whenever we talk about GDP is that there's a portion of GDP that will have no impact on the internet or could never be impacted by the internet. So we typically focus on what we call it's a business sector value added, which represents about 60% of GDP, and that's the amount of goods and services that are built by companies over the course of a year. The remaining 40% of GDP that you're talking about is typically things like imputed rent. So when you... And I know this is quite technical, but here in the United States, we have a lot of home ownership. And so what we have to do is when you're talking about calculating the value of goods and services in the U.S., you have to impute the rent that you would be paying on the home that you own. And so that amount that you would have been paying in rent had you been renting goes into GDP, and it makes up this roughly 40% of GDP. So it means that numbers of 2 to 3% of GDP are actually 2 to 3% of the 62% that's actually in play in any given year. So it just means that it's actually more significant. So I think it's a tricky number. We like to think of things in terms of GDP, but actually these numbers can be quite larger.
I would like to just make a point about, I don't want to give authoritarian governments a free pass to do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And as a human rights activist, I believe that you can make an impact. This is an economic discussion, so you can talk about raising the political cost of their actions. I also just Kat's point about the economic and the human rights being inseparable. It's important because this is a technical problem that's happening right now, and I mentioned that the targeting is getting more specific. So just looking further down the road, there's a problem if you are only dependent on the economic aspect. If it can be if a technical solution can solve that problem. So if you're a government, you want to shut it down, and you're like, actually, I just want to target six people in this protest. They target those people. It doesn't cost your company much other than having a direct conversation with us. We don't like that. So we want to be anticipating that. And human rights, you know, are indivisible. They complement each other. So the two need to go together. It needs to be a kind of heady mix. And if you just focus on, you know, whether people can get away with it, then I think we're not going to win this battle of shifting norms and making it something that's not okay.
I mean, I would add to that question, what do you do about countries that are completely focused on regime survival and they're not going to be focused even on the economic harms? Well, of course, that's just incredibly hard. But the reality is, and we've talked about this already, communication systems are global. There are companies, for example, part of the Global Network Initiative, that operate in countries where there are incredibly difficult human rights situations. And they're on the ground every day dealing with those challenges. What we have to think about is how we, you know, wrap around them a set of stakeholders, other governments that can, you know, create a space for a real conversation to happen. And it's incredibly difficult. There's no question. I mean, it's like sticking your foot in a door that's already been slammed sometimes. But that doesn't mean that, you know, we can't start. You know, countries have come out of being isolated, and they've become less authoritarian. And I think we have to think about the global internet as an important tool for you know, reducing that isolation. But there's no question that that's the hard basket. But there's also a set of countries in the middle that we've been talking about: emerging democracies, fragile democracies, countries like India and Brazil that have massive populations with, you know, incredibly different demographic profiles within those countries. If we can do some good work in those countries, I think you'll find that that will start to have an impact on their neighbours, and on countries that are more closed off than them. But I appreciate your question. That is, you know, that's the hardest issue that we have to deal with. But these countries, they all have telecommunications networks. They all have hardware on the ground, and increasingly their populations are using WhatsApp, they're using Allo, they're using all these tools. So it's also an enormous opportunity, I think, long term.
And if I could just add one quick footnote to what Kath said. The thing that surprised me the most in doing the study was, when I started, I was thinking this was going to be a problem of authoritarian regimes. And I learned that that's not the case. Mm. It's really the emerging democracies. Kath mentioned India and Brazil as offenders. Turkey, we used to think of as a democracy. You know, they're engaging in the same behavior. You know, this behavior, which we associated with authoritarian regimes, is now spreading to other kinds of systems. So that's something everybody should worry about, not just from an economic standpoint, but, as was pointed out, the human rights angle, civic dialogue, you know, many of the things that we value. Any other questions? There's a gentleman back there with his hand up.
Thank you. As a layperson, I was kind of wondering how easy it is to shut down the internet. And further from that, are governments around the world now structuring the architecture of the internet to make it much easier to turn off the switch, as it were?
Good question.
There's many different ways to shut down the internet. You can typically, and I'm not an expert in this, but typically I think there's an order that goes out from the government to the telecom operators that say you don't resolve domain names anymore for a certain batch, or you just disconnect. It's typically, I think, done via the DNS. Yeah. I'm not sure, but it's there are ways around it. Like I said, I think it is quite difficult to knock everything off. And even in Egypt, as you saw, people were able to find ways out around the internet blockage. So this is one of the messages I think that we need to get out, is that these things don't work and they make the public mad, and they're stronger and they coalesce around the people who are being blocked. So,
yeah, I agree with Taylor's point about, so when you type in, facebook.com or whatever, newyorktimes.com, it just won't, the ISP won't deliver the address to you. So they just remove that. I'm not a technologist, though, so don't quote me on that. But that's one way. There's an interesting article that just came out in Quartz that was based on information from a few years ago. But basically they're saying it's not quite what you would expect. A place like China has three main gateways. So something like 75% of the traffic goes through one particular gateway in China. So it's easy for them to control and censor that information. And if they wanted to shut down a good portion of the net, they could. But in other countries, Russia being an example, they're actually it's very widely distributed. So you consider this to be an authoritarian regime. And the article at least suggests that it's because of cybercrime, and there's incentive from the major operators at a technical level to spread out their servers all over the country so that they wouldn't be subject to this. But what we've seen, and what our partners, especially places like Dyn Research, have noticed, is that I mentioned the Iraq example. So all of Iraq will be shut down except for Kurdistan. In other places, the entire country will be shut down except for a satellite uplink that only certain ISPs know about. And then in other places, everything will be shut down except for one particular telco that it just so happens that all the government ministers have access to. So the forms take they're very different forms. People still want access. It's especially people, the leaders who are ordering these these blocks. But there's a great article in Wired a couple weeks ago, which I can share with you if you follow up, by April Glazer, where she walks through and actually talks with our chief technologist about the different forms that some of this blocking can have.
Okay, we are out of time, but I want to thank Kath, Taylor, and Deji for sharing their views, and we appreciate your